أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، باعث الأنبياء والمرسلين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، سيدنا وحبيب قلوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد، اللهم صل على محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. أما بعد، سلام عليكم جميعا ورحمة الله وبركاته. From the first night of our lectures, we have said that we live in a very special period of time. We live in a period of time when we are anticipating the coming of the 12th Imam. And the corpus of our traditions tells us that when he comes, he will establish justice and he will establish a monotheistic way of life. And we have also been told that he has an army that's going to assist him and that's going to help him. And that army is going to remove the oppressors, those who are creating injustice. And normally the oppressors are the 1% in a society or in a country. But the question that we are faced with is, what about the other 99%? How is he going to get them to establish justice? And how is he going to get them to live a monotheistic way of life? Is he also going to use the army for the 99% as well? When you look into a society, you normally find that the 99% are oblivious of what the 1% are doing. The 1% have them so busy with entertainment, with consumerism, with a particular way of life, they're oblivious to what's happening around them. So then how is the Imam going to instill justice within them? The Quran is very clear. The Imam is coming so that people establish justice. How is he going to instill monotheism within them? And the Quran is very clear. La ikraha fi din. There can never be compulsion in the religion. So then what is the Imam going to do? The Quran tells us, these are human beings. الَّذِينَ إِمَّكَّنَّاهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ. If we were to establish them on the land, they would do a few things. One, أَقَامُوا الصَّلَاةَ. They will establish prayers. وَآتَوُ الزَّكَاةَ. And they would give zakat. وَأَمَرُوا بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَنَهَوْا عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. And the tools that they're going to use to spread justice and monotheism is that they are going to encourage people towards goodness and they're going to discourage them from evil. We've been talking about how to build a jama'ah. And a jama'ah is one that is united on the haqq. So if we want to build a minuscule version of what the Imam is going to do at a global scale, then we also have to use the same tools. أمر بالمعروف والنهي عن Munkar. We have to enjoin goodness. And we have to be able to forbid and prevent evil. When we look in the corpus of ahadith, you find that the ahadith talk about amra bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar as if it is the life vein of a community. That the moment you pull these two elements out of a community, it's like pulling the plug on the community. In one hadith, we're told that either, the first imam says, either you will enjoin good and you will forbid evil, or the worst of you in the land, the worst of you in a society are going to become your leaders, and the best of you, khiyarukum, are going to raise their hands in prayer, and their prayers are not going to be answered. The ahadith are very strong. I'm just going to be giving you a glimpse of these ahadith. بئس القوم. The worst community is that community, قوم يعيبون الأمر بالمعروف والنهي عن المنكر. Is a community that takes lightly, they think it's a shame to do أمر بالمعروف والنهي عن المنكر. These two elements are very effective. If we have any doubt about the effectiveness of this element, then just bring to mind when Imam al-Hussein was leaving Medina and he made a statement over what was his mission statement and what are going to be the tools in his mission. And he said, وَإِنِّي لَمْ أَخْرُجْ أَشِرًا وَلَا بَطِرًا وَلَا مُفْسِدًا وَلَا ظَالِمًا وَلَكِنْ خَرَجْتُ لِطَلَبِ الْإِصْلَاحِ فِي أُمَّتِي جَدِّي. I have come out to seek reform in the ummah of my grandfather. Oh Hussein, how are you going to do that? Are you doing that with your army? Are you doing that with your sword? Hussein says, no. I have got two tools which are very effective. أريد أن أأمر بالمعروف وأنهى عن المنكر وأسير بسيرة جدي وأبي. I'm going to command people towards good and I'm going to prohibit them from evil. Now this is what happens when we look at the corpus of ahadith that we have. At the same time, we also look at the societies in which we live. And we live in a post-modern society. And our society as a whole espouses something called inclusivity. That we are supposed to be an inclusive community. Which means that if somebody has made a decision for their lives, that this is how they're going to live, this is their lifestyle, this is the behavior they're going to show, then they have made that decision for themselves. We need to respect that. No? We need to respect that and welcome them into the community, and they are a part of our community. We have to be an inclusive community. The question is, on one hand, how do you do nahya anil munkar, discourage people from evil, and on the second hand, also be an inclusive community? It's very easy to talk about enjoining good by itself. You can give 10 lectures on it. It's very easy to talk about being an inclusive community. You can give 10 lectures on it. But the reality in which we live, in the societies in which we live, the question that we're facing is, how do you discourage evil and enjoin good and be an inclusive community at the same time? That's a real question. Do you eliminate أمر بالمعروف والنهي عن المنكر? You can't do that. These are two arkan of the furu, the branches of our religion. Do you limit the scope of it? That we're only going to enjoin what is understood to be commonly good. And we're only going to discourage what is understood to be commonly evil. And everything else, people have their own choice and we respect their choice. My question there is, what if the whole community decides that something which is evil is good? What if the whole community or the whole society decides something which is good is evil? The hadith tell us at the end of times, one of the signs of the end of times is people will think of good as evil and evil as good. Would we ever have a revolution? Would we ever have a movement? Would we ever had the black civil rights movement? The emancipation of the slaves, if everybody sat there and said, but we've all agreed it's okay to have slaves. So how do you do أمر بالمعروف and نهي عن المنكر and also be an inclusive community at the same time? Now what I want to do tonight is to challenge some of our traditional understanding of these concepts. What I'm going to ask from you is your patience. Do not take my words out of context. Do not cut and paste them. Listen to it in its entirety. If you just take a sound bite out of it, you will have done yourself and myself a disfavor. So be patient with it. A traditional understanding of Amr bil Ma'ruf means I need to tell somebody to do good. I need to remind them of what is goodness and they have a duty towards it. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells the Holy Prophet, فَذَكِّرْ إِنَّمَا أَنْتَ مُذَكِّرْ. Remind them, O Prophet, for you are not but a person who reminds. And in many cases, that is our duty. But there are some cases where that definition is not going to be enough. So I want to start with an example. And I'm going to take you far away from our discussion, but I promise you I'll bring you back. We've been alluding to this example for a number of nights. And that is the example of addiction. What is an addiction? And what causes an addiction? Normally we say the addiction is caused by the chemicals in the drug, in nicotine, in alcohol. By the way, alcohol is a drug. In cannabis, in cocaine. What's interesting is if you look at the cross-section of a brain, if you look at an MRI scan of it between a person who has just consumed cocaine and a person who's just enjoying shopping, the two scans or the two images are very, very identical. So my question is, what causes an addiction? One of the realities of human life and the human condition is something called suffering. And everybody in their lives has to go through some level of pain and suffering, some grief, some anxiety, some sorrow, somebody passes away, somebody loses something. The fourth Imam, he says that you're looking for something impossible in this world. Somebody asked him, what are we doing that you say that we're looking for something impossible in this world? He says, you're looking for raha, comfort in this world. وَمَا خُلِقَتِ الدُّنْيَا لِلْرَاحَةِ. This world has not been created for comfort. What if I told you that addiction is a human being's way to try and manage pain and suffering? Be patient. It's a human being's way to deal with pain and suffering in his life. He couldn't find a healthy way of dealing with pain and suffering, so he found an anesthetic that works for emotional pain and suffering. And that anesthetic is sometimes a drug, it's sometimes technology, it's sometimes shopping and consumerism, it's sometimes another addiction. And for a short period of time, he can forget all the pain and suffering that he's going through. By the way, I'm not making up this theory. I've spoken to experts in the field, experts who are on the front line, experts who've been working in this area for over 30 years. Okay. In the 60s and the 70s, they carried out a research that revolutionized how people think of addiction. The research was very simple, and then later on it was repeated over and over again with human beings in different situations, and the results were the same. Coincidentally, this research happened to be in Vancouver. So they started by creating what one could describe as a mouse Jannah. They made a place where mice could be, and everything they wanted was there. A nice place to stay, a warm place to stay, the food that they need, the toys that they need. But then they offered them two water sources. One water source which was pure, and the second water source which had cocaine in it. And the assumption until then was if the mice tried out the cocaine, the drug is addictive, they would be addicted. And they carried out the experiment, and only a few mice actually got addicted. The rest were okay. Then they create what you would call a mouse Jahannam. the worst conditions for a mouse. And they put some mice in there, and they gave them the same thing. They gave them water which was pure and water which had cocaine in it. Most of the mice in there got addicted, and most of the mice died as well. They realized that an addiction is a person, a being's way of trying to deal with pain, with trauma, with suffering. When American soldiers had gone to Vietnam, about 80 to 90% of them were addicted to cocaine. And when the war came to an end and these soldiers are coming back to America, there was a big fear that we're going to have a heroin epidemic in America. When they came back and they helped them process the trauma and helped them settle back into their communities, only 10 or 20% of them were addicted. They came from a situation where they had a lot of trauma, and they even created more trauma for the people living there. Right? And they came to a situation where things were comfortable for them. And they came to realize that it's not the drug that causes the addiction, it's the state of the human being that causes the addiction. And I can continue to keep giving you example after example, but let me share with you something that our brothers who smoke, it will resonate with them. Now think about the times you smoke more than other times. Don't you notice when you're stressed out, you smoke more, and when you're not stressed out, you smoke less? So what is an addiction? Addiction is just a human being's way of trying to deal with suffering. Now, what conclusion do I want to take away from this? By the way, this idea is very important. In many of our communities today, we talk about addictions, we want to work on addiction, but we don't even have a simple idea or a good idea of what actually is an addiction. What causes it? If we understand this idea, it seismically changes the policies that we make in trying to deal with addiction. Now, what's the conclusion that I want to draw from this? The conclusion that I want to draw from this is that if we are working with people who have an addiction, it doesn't help us to model an addiction as an immoral problem. An act of immorality. Now let me be very clear over here. I'm not saying it's not haram. Problematic use of certain substances is haram, yes. I'm not trying to minimize the problem of addiction, creating a way out. I know very well what addictions can do. The havoc it can create in a family. And I'm not trying to excuse that. I'm just trying to shift our focus somewhere else. That if I want to work with somebody who has an addiction, how do I model it? Let's say I model it as an act of immorality. Okay. So I sit on the member and I address people. And I say, those who have these addictions to drugs, you should know that you are displeasing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Follow me just in this thought process. And if you continue doing this, you're going to go to Jahannam, the fire of hell. Let's say as a community, we ostracize them. And we tell them, please don't come into our gatherings. So we create more guilt within them. We create more emotional pain and suffering within them. Yes? Don't we do that? Okay. Let me ask you a simple question. What's the only way he knows to deal with pain and suffering? So let me ask you, are we helping the situation? Or are we exacerbating the situation? So now your next question should be, if we don't model it as an act of immorality, then what are we supposed to do? What is our role? What's our duty? Our duty is to help that person to overcome the challenges in his life, the suffering, the pain, the anxiety, the stress, the depression, the trauma, the lack of purpose and meaning in life. so that he can overcome this obstacle, which is the real cause of the addiction. You know, one of the communities that has been ravaged by addictions is the First Nations community. Whether it's in North America, in Australia, or New Zealand. And that community as a whole has gone through a lot of trauma. They have been removed from their lands. They have been separated from their traditions. Today in Canada, we formally, at the highest levels of government, recognize that the policies of the Canadian government in the last century have caused, and this is an official term that we use there, have caused cultural genocide for the First Nations communities. So addictions become very rampant in such a community. What are they doing about it? They've decided to bring them back into the community. Be patient with me, yeah? They've decided to revive community gatherings. They've decided to revive their traditions. They've decided to revive community echo chambers where somebody who's struggling and suffering can come in there and feel the love, the warmth, and the support of the community. Right? Now, if we understand this, I want to bring you back now to Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar. Okay? Our traditional understanding of Amr bil Ma'ruf was that it means to tell somebody to do good, to remind him to do good. Allow me to suggest a revision to that definition. Yes, we do have to tell somebody to do good. But sometimes, more importantly, we actually have to help them and teach them how to do good. We're going to begin with the assumption that this man is a good man. He's a moral person, and he wants to do the right thing. But there's an obstacle in his life. He's not been able to overcome that obstacle. My role is to help him overcome that obstacle. That's Amr bil Ma'ruf. Let me start with a very simple example, and we'll get into some more difficult examples. Let's say somebody comes into the masjid, a young man. Salat of Jama'ah has started. And this young man does not join the Jama'ah. Now I have two options over there. The first option, I can make the assumption this young man is a lazy young man. He does not want to pray in the Jama'ah. I'm going to tell him the ayat and the riwayat about the importance of praying Jama'ah. And maybe sometimes I have to do that. Or the other assumption I can make is to tell myself it is possible that this young man does not know how to join the Jama'ah. It is creating a lot of anxiety for him. That has become the obstacle towards doing good. I'm going to teach him how to join the Jama'ah and remove this obstacle on the way. What if we say that's Amr bil Ma'ruf? What's Nahi anil Munkar? To forbid somebody from doing evil. Yes, sometimes I have to remind him, Baba, you can't be doing these things. But many a times, he's got an obstacle along the way. Like that person who has an addiction has an obstacle along the way. My role is to help him overcome the obstacle. Let's say a person is struggling with certain habits. They're struggling with looking at inappropriate images. They're struggling with habits that come with looking at inappropriate images. As a father or a friend, I've got two options there. One is I can assume this person is an immoral person, and I need to remind them of all the ayat and the riwayat about it. Maybe sometimes we assume we don't even have a duty towards that. When we look at the ayat of the Qur'an that we have, when we look at the riwayat that we have a duty to enjoin goodness and to forbid evil. Or the other assumption I can make is that he has got certain obstacles that he's not able to overcome. Right? Maybe I need to have a conversation with him on understanding his trigger points, what triggers him towards it, recognizing when a trigger is coming towards him, how to refrain and stay away from those trigger points. And once that desire has been triggered, how to manage it. That's amr bil ma'ruf. That's nahi anil munkar. We sit down, we talk about it. Don't sit in your room by yourself. You're using your computer. Don't use it in the room. Don't use your laptop in the room. Come out. Use it where it's in public space. I say, you know, this is a very complicated thing. Why can't we just keep it simple the way it used to be? Huh? We used to sit down. We used to remind them of what their moral duties were. A few ayat of the Quran awaken the conscience. And we keep doing that. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with taking this person down the path of guilt over and over again? Won't it work at some point? So one of the things I have found in my experience, and these experiences are valuable, that when you walk down this path of guilt over and over again, at some point you come to a station which is called hopelessness. And when you come to that station that's called hopelessness, this person gets off the train forever. Right? Because they want to do good. They just have an obstacle that's blocking them from doing it. They feel helpless trying to overcome that obstacle. Every day you come and tell them you're worthless in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And there comes a point where they say, well, what's the point? We literally serve them up on a platter to shaitan. And my experience has shown, shaitan comes in, the first thing he says, why are you even struggling? You're never going to be able to do it. The second thing shaitan comes and says, now that you're worthless, now that you're not going anywhere in your iman, tell me, why do you say your salat? And I get emails telling me, this month of Ramadan, good people, pious people, raised really well, coming and telling me, I don't think this month of Ramadan I can fast because I feel embarrassed now to fast. You walk down this path of guilt enough, you'll come to a station called hopelessness, and somebody gets off the entire train. Right? So, when it comes to enjoining good, brothers, we do have a duty to enjoin good. We don't have a choice between enjoining good and living in an inclusive society. We have to enjoin good, but we have to enjoin good in a manner that brings people into the community, and from the community brings them closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The deen is very sensitive about this. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells the Holy Prophet, "Udu'u ila sabili rabbika bil hikmati wal maw'idhati al hasana." O Prophet, call people to the path of the Lord. Yes, tell them what is right. Tell them what is wrong. But when you're calling them, call them with wisdom. Bring them closer to you. لَوْ كُنْتَ فَضَّاً غَلِيظَ الْقَلْبِ لَنْ فَرُّ مِنْ حَوْلِكَ. O Prophet, if you are hard-hearted, if you are judgmental, if you pushed people away, they would have run away from you. Now when the Quran talks about hikmah, you find that our scholars talk about what are some of the conditions of doing amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar. Inshallah, in the time that's left, I'd like to go over three of these conditions if you recite a salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. First, every one of us, each and every one of us has a duty to do amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar. Yesterday we went through a hadith, and the hadith told us that the right of a believer on you is that you be his ayn, his eyes, wadaliluhu, his guide, wa mir'atuhu, you become his mirror as well. The duty to do amr bil ma'ruf wa nahi anil munkar is an individual duty. It's not just the duty of the member, the duty of the leadership, the duty of the committee, it's the duty of each and every person. One of the principles of community building in Islam is that in Islam, we build community one person at a time. Please take to heart what I'm about to tell you right now. We build community one person at a time. We've become too enchanted with processes because we live in a post-industrial era. And processes have worked really well in industrialization. In the 16th, 17th, 18th century, we came to realize that if you can make an assembly line, if you can make some nice processes, then you can have this nice factory. You take raw material, whatever those raw materials are, you put them in the factory, and on the other side, you get a finished product. And then we started thinking, even human beings are like that. If the Jamaat can come up with nice processes, then we'll take these human beings, we'll put them into this program, this initiative, this service, and on the other side, you'll get a reformed human being. No? And what we don't realize is that human beings are not simple as wood and lumber. They're very complicated beings. Right? They have their own histories. They have their own experiences. They have their own thoughts. They have their own problems. They have their own challenges, their own traumas. One shoe fits all doesn't work with human beings. Right? So we have to build community one person at a time. And that means each and every one of us has a role in building community. Okay. Two, is that when we want to do Amra bil Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar, we first have to develop a good relationship. It's very important. A trusting relationship. A loving relationship. Sometimes in the masjid, you see somebody's come in, they're doing something that's not the right thing. In many cases, my advice, or I say that before we snap at them or before we call them out, let's be patient. Let's invest a little bit of time in that person. Make them your friend. Build a trusting relationship with them. You've seen in your own life, if you trust the person who sits on this pulpit or you trust a speaker that speaks from here, even if he were to say something illogical, it goes into your heart the way knife goes into butter. No? You'll take it. And if you don't like the person who's speaking, they can throw the book at you, it ain't gonna help. Build trust. We have a hadith from the sixth holy imam. We're told that one of our imam recognized that one of the people around him was addicted to alcohol. Now the imam wants to forbid evil. But look at how he goes about doing it. So he waits for an opportunity. And one day as he's walking on the road, this man tells him that from this office I need a favor. I can't go into the office. Can you go into the office for me? So the imam, he goes into the office. He does that favor for him. He comes out. He gives it to him. This person feels that the imam has done him a favor. His love for the imam has increased. Right? The imam takes advantage of that time. He says to him, so and so, every good deed is a good deed no matter who does it. You walk in the street today, you see somebody picking up the garbage, you say, that's a good man. Or that's a good deed, no? Every good deed is a good deed no matter who does it. وَمِنْكَ أَحْسَنْ لِمَقَامِكَ مِنَّا But when you do it, it's even better. Because you have an association to us. And then tell you some so-and-so. Every bad deed is a bad deed, no matter who does it. Even if somebody in the community who is known to be pious does it, you will say, that was a wrong thing. وَمِنْكَ أَسْوَى But when you do it, it's even worse. لِمَقَامِكَ مِنَّا Because of your association to us. The man got it. The man understood. From that day on, he slowly started stopping his addiction. So two, let's build trust and a relationship with the person. The third thing and the final thing that's important when we're doing Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar is to be very humble when we do it. To be spiritually and intellectually humble when we are enjoining upon somebody to do good. In today's society, you would say, do not be judgmental. Okay? One of our scholars, in his Risala, he talks about the ahkam of amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, because they are the furu of our deen. Before he starts talking about the ahkam of amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, he gives us some pieces of advice. One of the advices he gives in there, he says that when you're admonishing somebody, treat him like a part of your own body that is ill. How much care you would give to a part of your own body that is sick? In the same way, you should care for him as well. And he says, never forget for a moment, it should never be lost upon you, that perhaps that person has done one thing good in their life for which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala may forgive them, and you've done something wrong in your life for which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala may punish you. Let's be humble. Let's not be judgmental. Let's be welcoming. If a lady is not wearing her hijab normally, she dresses decently. When she's outside the community, she doesn't wear hijab. She says her salat, she keeps her fast, she is respectful in her conversation, she is respectful in her interaction. Just because she doesn't wear the hijab does not mean that lady is an immodest person. Where does that judgment come from? It doesn't mean she wants to be an immodest person. Right? It could be for a million reasons, but not immorality necessarily. Maybe she hasn't been able to overcome Islamophobia. She hasn't been able to overcome peer pressure. Her self-image has become very important to her in the public sphere. It's something she has not been able to overcome. Maybe she hasn't understood about the importance of hijab. Okay. That doesn't mean that she's an immoral person. As long as she is coming to the community, she is not propagating that to others in the community, she is part of the community. If a person has an addiction, just because they have an addiction does not mean they are an immoral person. I say it before, I'm not trying to minimize it. Right? But we see there could be challenges in their lives that they have not been able to overcome. Right? And the only place they might be able to overcome it is in the community. The warmth, the love, the support of the community. As long as they're not influencing others. They're not in a position of where they're taken as a role model, for example. Right? They're part of our community. It's important that the jama'ah exists to uplift people like that. Amr bil ma'ruf does not mean we boycott them from the community. Amr bil ma'ruf means we welcome them in the community, and if they are struggling, we help them to overcome their struggles, inshaAllah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Let us take our hearts now to Karbala, to the place when Hur came to Imam al-Hussein, and the Imam realized that he's been able to overcome his challenges. Imam al-Hussein welcomed him. He brought him into his tent. When somebody didn't want to come to Imam al-Hussein, he used to go to them and say, be part of our jama'ah. Let us go to that place where hearts are big, where the vision is farsighted. Let us do tawassul to him. Ya Aba Abdillah, Ya Hussein ibn Ali, أيها الشهيد يا ابن رسول الله يا حجة الله على خلقه يا سيدنا ومولانا إنا توجهنا واستشفعنا وتوسلنا بك إلى الله
وقدمناك بين يدي حاجاتنا يا وجيهان عند الله.
إيش؟
عند الله يا وجيهان عند الله. اشفع.
As they were traveling to Karbala, Imam al-Hussein, whenever he would fall asleep, sometimes he would see dreams. On one of the days, he had been sitting on the ground, and he fell asleep, and he saw a dream. When he woke up from his dream, he said, "I fell asleep right now. إني رأيت الساعة جدي محمدا." Right now I saw my grandfather, the Prophet of Allah, and my father Amir al-Mu'mineen, and my mother Lady Fatima, and my brother Al-Hasan, and they're all saying to me, "O Hussein, إِنَّكَ رَائِحٌ إِلَيْنَا عَنْ قَرِيبٍ." Soon you shall be coming close to us, soon you shall be meeting us. When Lady Zainab hears Al-Hussein saying that he's going to return to Allah, she breaks down into tears, and Imam Al-Hussein tells her, "O Zainab, be patient, O Zainab, be patient." One of these days when Aba Abdullah was traveling towards Karbala, he fell asleep, and when he woke up, he said, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un, walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen." When Ali al-Akbar hears the Imam repeating this two or three times, he comes to the Imam and he said, "Ya Abati, my dear father, لِمَ حَمِدْتَ اللَّهَ وَاسْتَرْجَعْتَ." Why have you been praising Allah and reciting "Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un"? The Imam says to him, "O Ali al-Akbar, I have been reciting this because I saw a dream, and in my dream I saw the horsemen were moving closer towards us, and they were saying, 'This caravan is moving forward, and death is moving towards this caravan.' And I realized that soon we shall be dying, soon we shall be martyred." When Ali al-Akbar hears this, he says, "Ya Abati, O my dear father, look at Ali al-Akbar, look at the insight of Ali al-Akbar." He says, "Ya Abati, alasna ala al-haq, are we not on the right path?" Imam al-Hussein says to him, "Yes, my dear son, we are on the right path." So Ali al-Akbar says to his father, "Then my dear father, it doesn't matter whether we meet death or death meets us, for we shall have died on the right path." Imam al-Hussein says to him, "May Allah reward you the best of rewards." That was Ali al-Akbar. Because of his vision, because of his iman, he was beloved in the caravan of Imam al-Hussein. He was beloved to Imam al-Hussein. He was beloved to Lady Zainab alayha salam. On the day of Ashura, as the days passed by, when they came to the day of Ashura in the morning, the companions would go one by one to the battlefield. And as long as the companions were alive, they would not allow the family members to go to the battlefield. But when all the companions had fallen to the plains of Karbala, Zuhayr ibn al-Qayn had fallen to the plains of Karbala, Habib ibn Madahir, Muslim ibn Awsaja, when they were all Burayr had fallen to the plains of Karbala, and only the men and the family members were behind, they came to Imam al-Hussein one by one. And the first one of them to come to Imam al-Hussein was Ali al-Akbar. Al-Hussein would sacrifice his own first before he asked anybody else to sacrifice. And the narrator says, when Ali al-Akbar came to Imam al-Hussein, when Qasim came to Imam al-Hussein, he wouldn't permit him to go. When the other family members came, he wouldn't permit them to go. But when Ali al-Akbar came, the narrator says, فَاسْتَأْذَنَا, he sought permission to go to the battlefield. فَأَذِنَا لَا, without a moment of hesitation, Al-Hussein said, "O Ali, go to the battlefield."
That is Al-Hussein. That is the soul of Al-Hussein. I will say, O Ibrahim, when you had to sacrifice Ismail, you had to put so much around your eyes. It was so difficult for you. But look at this Hussein. When his son comes to him, he says, go to the battlefield, my son. But then the narrator also says, as Ali ibn al-Akbar was heading out to the battlefield, ثُمَّ أَرْخَى عَيْنَاهُ, then tears started to fall from his eyes, and he turned towards the heaven, and he said, اللَّهُمَّ فَاشْهَدْ, O Allah, bear witness, فَقَدْ بَرَزَ إِلَيْهِمْ غُلَامٌ أَشْبَهُ النَّاسِ بِرَسُولِ اللَّهِ, a young man is going towards them, who resembles the Prophet of Allah, خَلْقًا وَخُلْقًا وَمَنْتِقًا, in his features, in his physique, in his speech, and even in his character. Whenever we wanted to see Rasulullah, we would look at Ali ibn al-Akbar. And the young man heads out to the battlefield, and like everybody else, he announces himself. This is Ali ibn al-Akbar. He's not hiding his identity. He's not hiding his association to Aba Abdullah. Wherever he goes, even in the heart of the enemy, he tells them, know me for who I am. And he calls out to them, and the plains of Karbala heard him. Ana Ali ibn al-Husayn, ibn Ali. نحن وبيت الله أولى بالنبي. I'm Ali, the son of Hussein, the son of Ali. By the house of Allah, we are closer to Rasulullah. He fought bravely on that day. He killed many of the enemies. And after a while, he comes back to his father. And he says, my dear father, I've been fighting for a while. The day is hot, and I've only one thing to say to you. Al-Atashu qad qatalani, wa thiqlu al-hadid qad ajhadani. The thirst is killing me, and the weight of the iron is wearing me down. Then do you have a little bit of water for me? What does Hussein say to his son? Some of the narrators have said that when Ali ibn al-Akbar experienced the thirst of Imam al-Hussein, he said, my dear father, it seems you're even more thirsty than I am. But his father said to him, my dear son, فَقَاتِلْ قَلِيلًا, go and fight for a short period of time. Soon you shall return to Rasulullah. Soon you shall return to Amir al-Mu'mineen. And they will give you water from the Hawd of Kawthar. So Ali ibn al-Akbar goes back to the battlefield. He fights for a while. One of the enemies says, if he passes by me doing what he has been doing, I will make his mother mourn for him. I will make his mother cry for him. When Ali ibn al-Akbar comes near him, he takes a spear. He aims it at the heart of Ali. He aims it at Al-Hussein. The spear hits Ali ibn al-Akbar in the chest. He can't stay on the horse. He falls to the plains of Karbala. He calls out to his father, Ya Abata, alayka minni salam. My dear father, may my salams be upon you. And then he tells him, Ya Abatahu alayka salam, hadha jaddi yuqri'uka salam. I can see my grandfather, he is sending his salams upon you, and he is saying to you, Ajjil al-qudum ilayna, O Hussein, we're waiting for you. Hasten your steps towards us. When Imam al-Hussein hears his son, he rushes out into the battlefield. He reaches the body of Ali ibn al-Akbar. This tall young man, The one who stood on the plains of Karbala is now lying on the plains of Karbala. There is blood over his body. There is sand over his body. The narrator says, I saw Al-Hussein coming down from his horse. He sat down next to Ali in Al-Akbar. He took the head of Ali. He put it on his lap. And then he put his cheeks on the cheeks of Ali ibn al-Akbar. And then he said to him, Ala al-dunya ba'daka al-afa. My dear son, what is there in this world after you? And they took the body of Ali ibn al-Akbar back to the tent. The narrator says, that is the time I saw Zainab, the daughter of Ali. She came running out of her tent. She threw herself on the body of Ali ibn al-Akbar. And she called out to him, Wa Habiba, Ya Ibn Akha, O my beloved, son of my brother, what has happened? وسيعلم الذين ظلموا آل محمد أي منقلب ينقلبون إنا لله وإنا إليه راجعون يا حسين